let's try to put a huge amount of focus and attention on not the public policies and how they should be designed, but on the implementation infrastructure. There's work to be done everywhere to build a richer environment for government analytics.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Can better data analysis improve the way that a government functions? That's a huge question. It's inspired an ambitious project from the World Bank. The Government Analytics Handbook is both a practical how-to guide, if you want to do this, and a fascinating insight into how administrators can overcome those obstacles and challenges that get in the way. Daniel Rogger of the World Bank and Christian Schuster of UCL are the editors. They join me now. Dan, welcome.
Hey, Tim, how are you?
And Christian, great to be talking to you.
Hello, Tim. Thank you for having us.
Dan, first of all, how did this come about? Whose idea was a project like this?
The handbook and broader project was a natural progression from work that Christian and I had been doing with microdata to try and understand and improve how public administration works. And in this context, microdata measurements of the task or process level in administrative data or measurements of individual public servants. We've been doing this for some time. And once you do that with public servants, government officials, with bank staff, with other academics, you realize that this is being done in a lot of places, but in a very disparate way. It feels like individuals are trying to make progress on this almost on their own. And so what we wanted to do was build some kind of framework, a kind of way of thinking about how one should systematically repurpose administrative and survey data inside government to better understand how it functions. We've eventually come to call this government analytics. But because analysts around the world are in government trying to repurpose routinely collected data to actually make government better, there's this huge opportunity to bring that community together. So yes, there's a handbook, but in many ways, we see this as bringing together lots of individual activities into something a little bit more systematic so that the profession as a whole, public servants as a whole, can make better choices about how they're designing and implementing policy in government. What we're trying to do is just build a way to be more systematic, to learn from different efforts. It really was a natural progression from working on government data in a wide range of settings to meeting a host of these government analytics and academics and bank staff who were really all doing similar things that got us to bring this together, a sort of community around these ideas. So it's not just the handbook, but an effort to build a community around an amazing idea that we term government analytics, the spin-off of which is the Bureaucracy Lab that I lead, Analytics Fellowship, Global Survey, and everything we're going to talk to you about today.
I want to know what you mean by government analytics. Does this just apply to governments in low middle income countries, or is it all governments?
We define government analytics in our book as the collection or repurposing of administrative and survey data to better measure and ultimately improve the core public administration. And with core public administration, we mean the administrative machinery of government. That machinery that turns inputs such as goods, personnel, capital, through processes, through management practices, into actions and behaviors of public administrators, and ultimately outputs and outcomes. And the intuition behind government analytics is universal. It's not restricted to high-income countries or low-income countries. In fact, Dan and myself and many others have done a lot of government analytics work in collaboration with developing country governments, but also in collaboration with OECD country governments. When you think about how governments operate, then one foundational characteristic that typically comes to your mind is that governments are record keepers, not least because they need to show that they're acting in the public interest. So governments keep records of every good that they purchase, of every payment they make to a public servant, of every driver's license they issue, of every tax return they process, and so on. And these records used to be paper-based. They used to be stored in archives in giant basements of public sector buildings. But those archives in basements largely don't exist anymore. Why? Because over the last two decades, administrative operations in governments have been digitized in most countries in the world, both in the north and in the south. So most countries in the world now have electronic systems for public procurement, payroll, tax, land registration, business licensing, and so forth. And that in essence means that we now have millions and millions of government transactions in most countries that are now digital records. And all these digital records can be repurposed as data points for analytics, or what we call government analytics. For instance, to show that two public sector entities are paying very different prices for the same goods, paying very different salaries to two public servants doing the same work, that some tax offices process tax cases more quickly than others. Because of this global movement towards the digitization of government operations, government analytics can repurpose these digital records both in high and in low-income countries. High-income countries, of course, tend to be further in that digitization process, so your possibility frontier for analytics goes further, but there are lots of important analytics that are possible in low-income countries as well.
Is this analytics a big picture tool? It sounds like you can really get into the weeds with this.
You know, over the last 20 years, we've seen a revolution in how deeply we've measured the world. And what that measurement revolution has meant for government is that we now appreciate how diverse public administration is, perhaps in contrast to the sort of bland stereotype of previous times. And that diversity, and we're talking from organization to organization, from unit to unit, from individual to individual, has huge implications for how we do public policy. There's just a huge descriptive job to do for those of us interested in public policy to be able to appreciate the institution that we are trying to support. Diversity of the sort that we've seen implies what's useful is more local than perhaps the global approach that's sometimes taken. And, you know, the very incentives across public administration, which will be defined by these very diverse contexts that public servants are working in, are just going to be very different. So their interest in learning about what the world looks like are going to differ along with the variation in the context they're working in.
Government analytics is very much intended as a small picture tool, sort of to use your introductory phrase, Tim. Use microdata to assess one organization, one unit, one process at a time to address the particular obstacles to productivity that that unit or that organization has. But I think in two important senses, it's really also a big picture tool. It's big picture because when you have microdata, you typically get these small picture analytics at scale. So what I mean with that is, for instance, the UK civil service runs an annual survey of all of its more than 500,000 civil servants and produces management diagnostics for over 12,000 teams based on that to drive improvements at this very small picture team level. But if you make small picture improvements in 12,000 teams and address obstacles to productivity across 12,000 teams, then that plausibly aggregates to big picture performance improvements of government. And we know from research in the private sector by Nick Bloom and colleagues, for instance, that a lot of the variation in performance between firms stems from differences within a firm. And in particular, unproductive firms allow unproductive units inside the firm to persist. So understanding that small picture, the individual unit inside an organization, is in some sense really important for big picture public sector improvement. But I think it's also a big picture tool because the data sources that government analytics focus on and tries to improve the analytics on are really important contributors to global welfare. For instance, if you analyze public procurement data across the world, you are analyzing 12% of global GDP. If you analyze public payroll data across the world, you are analyzing 10% of global GDP. Finding margins for improvement there can have very significant global welfare returns.
Now, I was looking at this handbook, and it's a huge piece of work, so congratulations on pulling it together.
Thank you.
But it also occurred to me, why is it so necessary? Because governments everywhere have people who are educated, similarly educated, they're hardworking, they use similar skills on similar tasks. So why a handbook?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. There are amazing people working in public service around the world, and so we emailed many, you know, we tried to sort of get as much feedback on exactly this question is what is needed? How come we don't see so much analytics? And we've done an in-depth study in Latin America that is about to come out from the World Bank that really says, you know, there just isn't so much analytical and predictive data. It's just not happening. And so the question is why? Exactly for the reason that you're asking. So we did a survey of about 1,000 analysts from around the world as to why they're not doing more. The number one response, as often in public service, is there's just not resources being directed at analytics. It's just not seen in the public service as a priority. Mm-hmm. But then I'd go further. I don't really hear many people outside the service, right, outside the administration, outside government, calling for public service to be evidence-based in how it implements. We often say we want evidence-based policy, but surely we should be saying exactly the same thing, turning the same lens around and using it to understand how we should best implement, motivate the implementers, et cetera, inside public service. But then the other thing is there's just not really a professional body who have systematized advice and gathered sort of the world's efforts in this area. And that we can do something about. And this is one version of that. That's why it's an edited volume. We did co-author many of the chapters because this is something we're passionate about. But at the same time, we tried to draw in public servants. We tried to draw in academics who are interested in systematizing their knowledge to give to an analyst somewhere in Nigeria or Chile or Estonia so that they can sit down and just be prompted. Ah, that's what someone else did. Or you're right, that is something I should think about when doing a survey. So it's a little bit like just trying to consolidate the conversation. And that's something that public servants in the surveys of analysts we've done say there isn't very much training, there isn't much guidance. We felt that this was a good input to structuring the conversation.
When I talk to businesses in a private sector and the technology companies that they work with, this sort of analytics, it's an obsession for them and has been for quite a few years now. Trying to get the analytics right, they find it equally tough, trying to derive some value from it. From what you're saying, it sounds like the public sector's playing catch up here. It's a little bit behind.
I co-lead a lab here at the bank called the Bureaucracy Lab. It's tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
You know, sort of. And my co-lead is Zahid Hasnain, and he was part of this team that really invested GovTech. And about 10 years ago, the public sector had invested harder than the private sector in the machinery to try and do analytics, but it didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think it's what are these, what they called analog complements. And I think it goes back to this idea of a culture of analytics. And you're right. Now, the top tech firms have really understood the value of this. And in fact, I'm losing staff members to Meta and Facebook and Google because there's just this realization of the marginal value of those individuals. So there is a lot to learn from the private sector's valuation of analytics and the laboratory system that they've set up and the use of economists towards that. At the same time, I think we always have to remember that government does different things. And it has different people, and therefore it probably needs its own analytics. So why didn't we just say, why not apply good analytics that you can do in the private sector, the public sector? That's because lots of features of the production function do differ. You know, processing, tasks, meritocracy, all these pieces that matter in the public sector environment that just aren't as focused on in the private. That's why different analytics is needed and why we want as many researchers and analysts around the world to take the view that the skills they have on evaluating public policy should now be used to understand the implementation of that policy as well.
Analytics, at its very basic level, involves making us more accountable because we are being measured. And now, is a cultural commitment to that measurement and acting on what that measurement tells us, is that important when we come to government analytics?
The short answer here is yes, but with a bit of nuance. Dan and I think of government analytics in the first place as a tool for learning for public managers, rather than in the first place being a tool for accountability. So if you're a public manager, then traditionally you make management and operational choices based on tacit and qualitative knowledge. So you observe how your organization works, you chat with your team members, you interact with your service users, and then based on that, you try to figure out what you should be improving. The objective of government analytics, as we detail in the book, is really not to measure away the manager, but to complement that managerial knowledge and ultimately enrich those conversations about what should be done with data. That does require a change in how government officials make management and administrative decisions. And so it does require a cultural change, but it really requires sort of in the first place, a cultural change towards wanting to learn from data when deciding how you manage a team or how you manage a process or how you manage a task. And then I think beyond learning, you're absolutely right that there's, of course, often also an accountability component. So if your superiors also see data about the low productivity in your team, or if the public has access to the data, that, of course, does generate sort of internal or external accountability. We do know from our own work that if you make transparent how procurement contracts are awarded, whether public sector jobs mm-hmm. are based on merit or political grounds, for instance, that's of keen interest to the public. It's of keen interest to the media. So you have lots of accountability through that. So in that sense, it also does require a cultural change towards accepting the transparency and potential accountability. Now, you could be quite pessimistic about it, but I think there's also reasons to be optimistic. So if you think about public policy for a moment and not public administration, you know, we used to not have household surveys measuring poverty rates or inequality rates. We used to not have randomized control trials that make it perfectly transparent whether a policy was effective or in fact failed. And all of that is now culturally accepted in many quarters. And so we do hope that we can see that same shift towards also culturally accepting that we should measure public administration and that administrative machinery of government, not just public policy.
Many of the features of the public service are here at the World Bank. I do feel like a public servant much of the time. And I like doing research on public administration because I'll sort of pause and say, how would I respond to this? What's my world like? And I think the first part of what Christian's saying, it resonates with me more than this idea of external punishment, because the conversations that we have here at the bank, or that I find when I'm with other public servants, they're just changed when you put some analytics on the table, when you can say, we're here in the distribution, and it changes how we talk to each other. I think the conversations that are had in public administration matter hugely. And if we can change the nature of those conversations, if we can start with a different default, which I think government analytics starts us off on a more empirical grounding, then those conversations feel richer from my experience. And one example of this is the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey, the world's longest, richest survey of public servants. It's the US federal government survey. And when the results come out, if you wander around near the World Bank, federal government workers are discussing it in great detail. Did you see the results came out? Oh, that manager's doing terribly. Oh, maybe I should move there. Maybe I should go to this organization. And it just changes the narrative that people in public service have about their own service. And so I want to do that at the World Bank. I think it's great that that's happening at the federal government of the US and beyond. So it's really about changing the conversation more than it is fear of external punishment that I think is going to motivate better service.
The word that both of you are using all the time at the moment is change. And not just in the public sector, but in the private sector as well. One of the biggest challenges is, when presented with analytics, having the appetite to change. Is it important that if you are going to invest in analytics, you also have to be institutionally flexible enough to take note of them and change when the analytics tells you that's a good thing to do?
Yes, of course. But I think to some extent also no. So generally speaking, effective organizations strike a balance between continuity on the one hand, because change is costly. So like, for instance, you have learning costs mm-hmm. for employees to use new tools, new procedures, and deliver new products. So you want to strike a balance between continuity, and there are good reasons for that. But then innovation on those margins that improve productivity the most. And I think government analytics is helpful because it can help organizations understand those margins. But that obviously doesn't mean that they necessarily act when presented yep. with those findings. That sort of begs the question, what makes it more likely that they would act? You mentioned flexibility. So in the handbook, we have a chapter that basically tries to infer what needs to be in place for governments to act on findings from data that they themselves collect. So we use the experience of 6 governments that all run every year national surveys of public servants with hundreds of thousands of public servants. And we look at what needs to be in place that they make improvements based on the results of that massive analytic investment. And the core conclusion from that chapter is that you don't just need high quality information, you don't just need managerial learning based on that data, but also 2 other things that make it more likely that improvements actually happen. One of them is managers, they need to have the capacity to act on results. And the other one is they need to be motivated to act on results, which can in part come from accountability. So for instance, if your analysis shows that an organization that they have a very large gender pay gap, larger than anyone else in government, and you have some data that suggests that that is likely because of discrimination. Do they have an incentive, a motivation to do anything about it? Do they have the technical capacity to do anything about it? And if not, then you need to think about instilling those. So can you provide advice on how they could restructure their pay and promotion processes to reduce gender discrimination, for instance? Do you need more accountability for change, for instance, by releasing that data point to the press, to the presidency? So I guess in answer to your question, Tim, you get flexibility to change in the first place through learning, but then if those who learn also are able to act and are motivated to do so, that's at least how we think about it in the book.
Government bureaucracies have a long history of collecting data. Is that data sufficient to be able to do analytics, or do they have to invest more in data collection and processing?
One of the interesting aspects of government analytics, at least based on administrative data, is that you typically don't need a data collection infrastructure,
yeah.
But what you need is a data repurposing infrastructure. What I mean by that is the data for your analytics is not collected by you, but it comes from digital systems for government operations that in essence collect that data for you. So a tax system collects tax records, a procurement system collects procurement records, a business licensing system collects business license records, and so forth. Now, the trouble, however, is that these digital records of, you know, who bid for a procurement contract, the timestamp of when a business license was awarded, they are not created for analytics. They are created to enable government operations, for a tax return to be issued, a business license to be awarded. So you need investments in a data repurposing infrastructure. You basically need investments to ensure the records are stored appropriately, they're shared securely with an analytics team, they're repurposed by that team as data points, and so forth. And so you really need to build institutional capacity to actually make sense of those records. In the handbook, for instance, we have a chapter on this. One proposal is that governments could create a government analytics unit in the center of government with expertise in just that.
One thing about creating expertise is you need experts as well. And more or less every conversation I have about analytics, at some point someone says it's really hard to get the data scientists. There aren't enough of them and we can't do the work we need without them. Do you feel that there is a shortage of expertise as well in governments, that they need to have more people who know how to do this analytics?
It would be great to have lots of what we call analytics scientists.
Yeah, great, yeah.
But there's three concerns about that. The first is public service rightly moves slowly on many margins and wrongly, right? Yeah. Rightly because you don't want government to just flip to the newest idea all the time. You also want it occasionally to do that when it's appropriate. And so you're always going to have a stock of public servants who were hired in previous generations with different skills. And the conversation that I was talking about before is between new skilled entrants and those who are already there. And so there has to be some maturing of the conversation or of those individuals who are there towards this understanding that this stuff is useful, even if they don't do it. So there is some need for the existing stock of public servants everywhere to better appreciate that we're in a new realm and there's a lot of value in the treasure box that they've been sitting on. We've got to, again, engage with the full service. The second thing is, I think why we wrote the handbook is because analytics, as done elsewhere, doesn't always, and I'd say quite often, doesn't fit the public service. The public service all over the world does different things. Each public service really has their own protocols, their own IT systems, and you need an organic process to craft from the very measures and variables in those systems up to something useful. And so it really has to be service by service. There's no silver bullet here, I think. And that organic process means you've got to inspire people to get into the service. It's not just getting data scientists to come across because they get a good salary. It's their desire to move into service and actually make social marginal change. The third piece is, yes, let's get phenomenal, bright, engaging data scientists who appreciate public service norms and protocols into hubs like Christian was suggesting, and then actually spread them throughout. And then we could have a lot of conversation about whether you have special fellowship schemes, whether you have people coming from the private sector or from data science labs in and out. I think we don't know enough about how to do that. But it's going to be a combination of those three. It's not going to be any single one.
This takes time, though. It's difficult to do. In the meantime, if someone in public service somewhere feels we're behind, we're not ready to produce some results from our analytics yet, these guys seem similar to us. They seem to have done the work. They've got stuff that works. Is it okay just to copy what other people do?
Oh, you're asking a World Bank staff.
I want an
answer. Dangerous territory. You know, I think there's a few pieces here. We actually had this conversation yesterday as a department about the use of technology in fragile conflict situations. Let's start in the most fragile environments. Actually, it's there that maybe we can apply technologies from the frontier more easily and do that jump. So for example, on payroll, maybe everyone can have a great payroll app that you can do civil servant surveys on that securely transfers funds and does performance pay. That feels like the administrative architecture, the legal architecture, is still at a point where you could make those big leaps at the lower end of the income distribution. So in some sense, it's the exact opposite. It's the people who are least like the frontier that may be able to make the most progress. Mm-hmm. The top end of the distribution, where you can learn a lot from each other, I think there we've already created that cultural environment, but also legal environment, GDPR in the European setting, but then similar legal environments across the world. Often they've got very advanced systems which have made a lot of decisions on defaults. So it's actually quite hard to copy and paste because just so much has already been decided before you get to the point of saying, should we use what Luxembourg's doing? I use Luxembourg because there's a case study in the handbook about how fantastic their integrated data system is. But really, in the end, this community of practice, we believe, is going to be a real boon to doing government analytics better. We just haven't documented this at scale. We haven't had enough podcasts on it. We haven't had enough mini TV series on Netflix about it. We haven't spent enough time really understanding the exciting world of public administration and the analytics that drives it. So yes, that's where you're going to get inspiration, not copy and paste.
What would Luxembourg do isn't a question that's normally asked on VoxDev Talks.
Well, then we're breaking new ground.
You are increasing our knowledge in this area, but one thing caught my eye, the Global Survey of Public Servants. Tell me, what's the motivation behind this?
What we are hoping to achieve with the Global Survey of Public Servants, or GSPS, is to generate global microdata to better understand how public administrations work and how they could work better. And we try to generate that understanding through the lens of public servants by creating high-quality, large-scale, comparative survey data from public servants around the world. And we think that lens is important because it gives us insights into several key determinants of public sector productivity. For instance, the quality of management and leadership. If you want to know something about that, it's ultimately an experienced interaction between a manager and an employee. If you want to measure it, you have to ask public servants. Or the attitudes and behaviors of public servants. For instance, how motivated public servants are around the world. The only way to really measure that is by asking public servants. I should preface that the GSPS is very much not just Dan and my initiative, but led by a consortium of researchers at the World Bank, the Stanford Governance Project, led by Francis Fukuyama, as well as my longstanding collaborators, Jan Meyers-Dowling and Kim Mikkelsen. And what we do in practice in the initiative is we run a lot of national surveys of public servants with governments in a comparable way across the world. We also collaborate a lot with governments that already run national surveys of public servants to help them redesign them, make them more comparable across countries. And we do a lot of work to try to improve the evidence base on how we can best survey public servants. So we have 8 chapters providing evidence on how to better survey public servants in our handbook, for instance. The rationale for that methodological work is that we have decades of experience measuring households, measuring firms with thousands of methodological and measurement validation studies, but we have much less experience and evidence on how to survey public servants at scale. So that's part of what we're trying to do. We also run these surveys because we want to improve management. So we have produced over 750 management diagnostics now for government organizations. And I think it's fair to say I'm really proud of the hundreds of management improvements that have come from those as well.
How broad's your coverage?
So we currently have data from 29 countries, over 1,400 government institutions, well over 1 million respondents. If you want to access the data, you can visit our data dashboard at globalsurveyofpublicservants.org/indicators. Of the 29 countries, 19 are countries that we surveyed as part of the consortium. 10 are countries that run their own national surveys, like the US and the UK, for instance. While we have 29 countries now, this is really a growing initiative. So we have about half a dozen surveys in the field right now. So the ambition is really to grow this data set over time. Because of course, the more countries you have, the more valuable this is for governments, because they can benchmark themselves with more other governments, including some that they think are more alike to them. And the more countries you have, the more valuable this is as well for scholars, because they can make broader comparisons, more interesting comparisons based on the data.
Someone listening to this who wants to contribute because they are part of some institution that would be relevant for your data, how can they do that? How can they get involved?
On our website, we have a dedicated section on that. In fact, it's called How to Run the Survey. So if you're interested in running the survey, that's sort of the best place to start. We have on the website our core questionnaire in different languages, the survey CTPO programming of that, so you don't, in fact, need to program the survey yourself. We also have a battery of optional modules that allow governments to complement this sort of core module on core civil service management practices with topics that are particularly interesting to them. So some governments have worked with us on remote work or corruption or training or onboarding or many others. It allows you, in essence, to have this cross-country comparator module and then to adapt the survey to the particular management challenges that you want to address in your country. And then on the website, we also have a lot of other resources, for instance, marketing guides to help you market the survey to public servants and so forth. But perhaps most importantly, we also have a contact form on the website that links to us. So if you're interested in implementing the survey, please do get in touch with us. We're very keen to expand this globally, and we're very keen to work with countries around the world that are interested in implementing this.
For this survey, have you managed to pick up any useful information, learn anything so far?
If you ask more than a million public servants about their experience in public service, there are a lot of insights.
Yes.
And lots of country-specific findings that have been helpful for governments and also interesting from a research perspective. But let me maybe share three cross-country insights. What can we learn about public service globally based on the data? The first type of insight which we find helpful is that it allows you to cross-check the stereotypes you have about public servants with data. Ah. Let me give you one example. One typical stereotype about public servants is that they have no performance incentive. Implication, they don't work hard because there's nothing in it for them. They have job stability for life. They get promoted based on years of service. There's no performance pay. We ask public servants around the world whether that's actually true. We ask them whether their work performance matters for them to keep their job, to get a pay rise, to get promoted. And what we found, the stereotype about pay and job stability being detached from performance, is true in most countries, mm-hmm. but the stereotype about promotion incentives is not. In most countries in the world that we surveyed, most public servants think that their work performance matters for their promotion prospects. Generally, we find this helpful because we have all these stereotypes, we can cross-check them against data. And I think the second global insight is that it gives you a sense of, across the world, what are some of the strengths in public administration and what are some of the shared challenges. In our data, we find that most public servants in the world are satisfied with their jobs. In fact, in every country we survey, the majority of public servants is satisfied with their jobs. But at the same time, in most countries in the world, most public servants are not satisfied with their pay. It gives you some sense of the kind of strengths that public services have. They're great at creating jobs that people are content with. They're less great at creating pay that people are content with. The third nugget or insight comes back to what Dan outlined earlier, and that is that in country after country after country that we survey, we see just how incredibly diverse the experience of public servants inside public administration across organizations is. Typically, there's more variation inside a government from one organization to the next than there is between countries. You have fundamentally different management challenges inside the same government across organizations. And that's something that we see over and over again. And that for me is in some sense sort of the beauty of having global survey and global microdata. You can both benchmark across countries and understand global patterns, but at the same time, you provide data that captures these very different organizational realities inside the same government and allows organizations to understand their challenges tailored to their organization, but within the context of their government and within a global context.
Coming from an applied, you know, micro-trained background, there's this tension in my life between this global data sets and saying something about a very specific parameter in a specific public service.
And so if you talk to public servants, one of the stereotypes that you hear about is the public service is a coherent place. Actually, it can be a very lonely place for analysts. A lot of the analysts we talk to, they feel alone. They feel like, well, I'm trying to innovate here. And maybe it's natural that an innovator is always going to feel a bit lonely, particularly in an administrative setting. By trying to assure and support individuals trying to make those innovative changes in service, that is a good thing in itself. Public servants say to us, well, how can I compare myself? So once you get a good survey of public servants, it allows them to see other parts of their public service. But often you'll get a minister of health or a ministry of health that'll say, but you know, we're the health sector, we can't compare to anyone else in our country. So then you say, okay, with all the caveats, here's health sector surveys from around the world. And it gives just that little piece of, okay, I better understand where I am in distributions that might be meaningful to me. We want to give very context-specific, very micro-founded advice. And we do that with these really micro-data-founded initiatives. But we always get this question of, well, this is great, but what does 60% motivation or turnover intent mean? So we say, okay, well, here's other data. And so it's always towards this idea of building a community, building a variety of bits of information for that analyst who's sitting there in the Ministry of Health feeling like they're alone and they just need support in different ways.
I'm hoping that there's people listening to this, nodding their head, maybe feeling heard. This is a separate activity to the handbook. Does it complement it? Do they dovetail?
I think Dan and I very much envision the handbook both as a guide on how to undertake government analytics, but also as a repository of tools that can help governments and researchers undertake these analytics at a lower marginal cost. And so I think the complement here is as follows. In the handbook, we have one whole volume, 9 chapters, dedicated on how to survey public servants well. Those chapters inform the Global Survey of Public Servants. But at the same time, we think of the Global Survey of Public Servants and all the tools that come with it, questionnaires, marketing guides, as an instrument to lower the cost of putting in practice this part of the handbook. And I think it's worthwhile to say that the handbook also links to a lot of other tools. So Dan, for instance, developed the Worldwide Bureaucracy Indicators with colleagues, which are the key global tool if you want to understand public sector labor markets through the lens of household surveys. So our chapter on that links to that. In the procurement chapter, we link to the PROACT procurement dashboard developed by the bank and Mihaly Fasekas, which is a global dashboard of procurement data that lowers the cost of procurement analytics around the world. So the complement here is that the GSBS is one of several global tools that in some sense help analysts lower the cost of putting some of the insights from the handbook into practice and that also make these analytics globally comparable.
We covered a lot of ground, but there is one other thing I want to ask you about. A few months ago, you hosted 40 government analytics fellows at the World Bank. What was the purpose of this?
It goes to that idea of building community. We'd love to have much closer relationships with analysts around the world trying to do this work, bring them together. And so the idea was to really commune like-minded fellows, individual analysts around the world. Not seniors, so people mid-tier who, if they buy into this idea, they had to apply to us with a project in mind, maybe something they're already working on. And the idea is we would strengthen their ability to implement the project they were already doing. But of course, if you buy into that now and as you rise through the service, that's going to have dividends for the just cultural aspects of accepting government analytics later on, which we talked about. So I think the purpose was bringing people together, less loneliness about being an analyst, sharing best practice, and also starting to seed this idea all around the world of this is a good way to run administrations.
Community building, especially in its early stages, can be very difficult to do. When you asked people to get involved, was there demand?
Oh, yes. You offer people to come to the World Bank and there was a lot of demand, but we were very careful about selecting. You know, we invested a lot of time in trying to find people where we felt that our support, and when I say our, it was quite a body of bank staff and we had some academic colleagues and policymakers themselves were presenting to each other. We tried to be very careful to select a group where we thought we could make catalytic impact on their project, so that it would really jump. And of course, that demand is still there. It's early days, I think, as you're implying, for this kind of work. So I do want to suggest to anyone listening who feels that they can commune groups like this, go for it. Let's build communities like this around the world. The demand, we're talking many thousands of applications, is really very large. Our suggestion is let's try and replicate these sorts of initiatives. We're putting all the resources online. We've got our recordings curated online. So we're giving our bits of the resources. We will do the fellowship every year ourselves. We will get camped. So if you can, please fulfill that demand yourself.
And when you sat down with them in the room, what did you learn from what they had to say?
You know, part of it is the struggle of doing this, is that this is new, that there is a cultural barrier to doing it. Part of it is that we're still very focused on descriptive work. What proportion of public servants are paid at this grade? Not, are we likely to lose some of those folks next year? You know, what does history tell us? Or how much are people moving around through the payroll? Does that tell us something about different profiles of public servants? Is, you know, kind of more analytical and certainly very little predictive. So there is analytics going on. There's a lot we could do to nudge it up. If we want to strengthen public policy, these are the folks to do it with, because they're already working on the mechanics and machinery. Everything we can do to improve these folks' ability to raise their analytical quality from descriptive to analytical to predictive and so forth, we're just strengthening the work that's already being done in a strategic manner.
That's what you could learn from them. Did you find out anything about what they wanted from you?
Yeah, I think we're talking about quite a varied group. Some folks had data science masters and had been working as the director of analytics departments for quite a long time. At that top tier, they very much enjoyed the mentoring side. So what we did is we set up every fellow with some mentors or a key mentor, either from within the bank or someone technically close to their work. That was a really nice piece. And I think it builds very nicely on the kind of professional community that economists are already, which is we want to have direct impact on policy, but often there's a challenge to actually finding the right person. And so if we could do a bit more of that matching, I think they really enjoyed that. We had top civil servants from, say, Australia and the US, and they said to us, it was the conversations I had with everyone else about how to implement my analytical work that was really nice. At the other end of the distribution, you know, we did have folks who, I think, every single module was new to them, from how to get a balanced range of data when you're thinking about how to analyze any specific topic through payroll analytics to doing civil servant surveys. I think for a good proportion of our fellows, there was new content there that we know because we're in touch with the fellows, they've gone back and implemented in service. So I think it's always going to be a mix of how do you support analysts? It's going to be partly teaching, but then it's going to be mentoring and it's going to be having a rich conversation. My own mentors, one was from the lower end of the distribution of countries' capacity and one from a higher place. And in both cases, just having someone who's gone through similar experience implementing similar analytics was a very powerful combination. So it's that hopefully triad of different approaches that has been useful.
It's obvious how much work that you've done so far, but it's also obvious how much work there is to do and how important it is. So what's the future for this program?
We're at a very nascent stage. Government analysts inside government, they're the ones who are going to do this work and they're who we should support. So how do we support best? We are going to continue the fellowship. We're going to continue to try to expand the Global Survey of Public Servants. We're going to continue to try to make the toolkits and the handbook useful. So please, if you're interested in these topics, go and see what we've put online already. And if you feel you can enrich any of those resources, get in touch with us. We'd love a partnership.
I think there's also a future of the program for universities. If you go to a school of public policy or a school of public administration, you're being taught the substance of public administration. You take an intro to public management class. You're being taught statistics for policy, policy evaluation, for instance, or policy analysis. But you're never taught public administration measurement or public administration analysis. And we do think and hope that the course that we've developed is also interesting for colleagues that are in public administration schools around the world that could complement what they already teach in terms of statistics for policymaking, in terms of the substance of public administration, with dedicated courses on statistics of public administration. Because ultimately, that is one key vehicle you have to ensure that those who undertake this work in government were actually trained for that work at universities, rather than having to transfer skills they learned from statistics for policy evaluation, for instance. We have made all our course materials available online in part to support that and hope that other colleagues at universities around the world can replicate that teaching.
We'd love to continue to develop the tools that the profession has as a whole, specifically for government. I really don't think we're going to be able to just port across tools that already exist. And so as many economists, public administration scholars, data scientists, let's try to put a huge amount of focus and attention on not the public policies and how they should be designed, but on the implementation infrastructure. The future of this program is that the personal economics of the state, government analytics, whatever you want to call it, becomes a significant part of how we think about doing better public policy, doing better economic development. There's work to be done everywhere to build a richer environment for government analytics.
Thank you for your time, Dan.
Thank you so much, Tim.
And Christian as well.
Thank you so much, Tim.
If you want to follow up on this and see more of Dan and Christian's work, then first of all, the Government Analytics Handbook, you can find that on the World Bank's website. You can even Google it. That's what I did. Other search engines are available. If you want to get involved with the Global Survey of Public Servants or just look into what they found out so far, then the website for that is www.globalsurveyofpublicservants.org. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes are at voxdev.org. And I think probably more for this episode than anyone we've ever done, if you know someone that's going to be interested in the content that hasn't listened so far, well, tell them about us, and then they can find out about episodes like this one.